Alexandra Pringle was editor-in-chief at Bloomsbury Publishing for more than two decades, having relinquished the position only recently to become executive publisher. She began her career at the British magazine Art Monthly before joining the woman's publisher Virago in 1978. She became editorial director in 1984, moved to Hamish Hamilton in 1991 to perform the same job. Through much of the 1990s, she was a literary agent for writers, including Amanda Foreman, Jeff Dyer, Maggie O'Farrell, and Allie Smith. She joined Bloomsbury in 1999 as head of the adult publishing division, where her authors included Margaret Atwood, Elizabeth Gilbert, Sheila Hancock, Ann Michaels, and Patchett, George Saunders, and Richard Ford. Welcome to the Bibliophob.
Thank you.
I want to start off with two quotes. The first quote is from Christopher Middleton, and he's commenting about Robert Louis Stevenson's In the South Seas in a book called A Factotum in the Book Trade. I've just interviewed the author of that. It's a memoir of a bookseller. And what Middleton says about Stevenson's book is, so it is always on the brink and leaving something to the reader or to the listener, which is not just a secret and not just a mystery, but is the sense of being on the verge of something. And that's what I suppose resonance and suggestion are all about. And one more quote to connect with this. I picked up Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces just right after reading that. And on the first page, Campbell writes about fairy tales and myths. It will always be the one shape-shifting yet marvelously constant story that we find, together with a challenging, persistent suggestion of more remaining to be experienced than will ever be known or told. My question is, how do you perceive this and how do you achieve this?
I mean, I think a lot of this is instinctual. And indeed, much of what an editor's job is an instinctual job. So it's actually very hard to pin down and to define it, because the relationship between you as the reader, the editor, and the text that you're reading is very intimate and quite mysterious, I think. And when you work with an author, I always think of it as sort of climbing into the book with the author, particularly if it's fiction. I personally often don't even know what I'm going to say to the writer until I start saying it. So I'm not one of those editors that prepares everything beforehand. I have it all swinging around in the back of my head, and then I allow it to come forward, and I'm often quite sort of stumbling at the beginning of the conversation, and I prefer to edit through conversation than on the page. So I think that sense of there being more is something that you do with your fingertips and you understand with your fingertips. And I think the reason why we read is because we want to discover things. And a lot of, and I'm talking particularly actually about fiction, that you want to go into worlds that you don't personally know. I mean, having said that, you also want to examine the world that you know, but much of the experience, like Robert Louis Stevenson, a Kipling, for when I was 11 or 12 and reading Achebe's Things Fall Apart, that extraordinary experience of walking into a completely different world. Nothing is explained really in good novels, is it? You're whispered at a lot of the time. You are given characters and you're given places and you're given stories, but what you make of them is the work that you do as the reader.
The fundamental question is, what keeps you reading? And, you know, as an editor, this is the sense that you want, is the when you pick it up, you want to keep reading?
Of course you do. But there are various strands to that. One is the quality of the prose. So sentence by sentence and word by word, is the prose working for you? Is it lighting you up? Or sometimes the best prose is the prose that sits back and doesn't display itself, but is so adept. I think that's often the hardest prose to achieve. And I remember when I published years ago Esther Freud's first novel, Hideous Kinky, it was written with such a lightness of touch because it would be very easy not to see how much art went into it. And I was quite frightened when we published it that I was at Hamish Hamilton at the time, that wouldn't be perceived. But there was a review by Gabrielle Annan in the TLS that said it has the art that conceals art. And I thought, that's great. We're home and dry. That's exactly what it is. So there are many different, there are so many different styles of writing, but the prose is one of them. And then, of course, the story and the depth of the characters are the other thing. So there are three strands, really. And sometimes when you read a first draft, one aspect is working very well and a couple aren't. I mean, I tend not to work with writers where I have to spend a great deal of time on the prose because I only publish them because I love their prose. So if they run into difficulties, it's usually a more structural affair that I'm engaged in.
Okay, I want to get into a narrative arc in our interview here. But first of all, I've done some research. I approached a prominent Bloomsbury author, and I asked her to give me the goods on you. And what
you're trying to scam me.
And what she said was to be sure to ask about the parents and the houseboat. So let's start with the houseboat.
Okay. What do you want to know about the houseboat?
Well, you live on land, right?
I do, yes.
So why do you live on a houseboat?
Well, the short answer is that I fell in love with somebody who was living on a houseboat. The long answer is that I grew up around here in Chelsea. And when I was a little girl, I used to go for walks along by the river. And I used to look at the houseboats and think, oh, they are so romantic. I wonder who lives on them. I wonder what it's like being on them. And I had a great friend who lived in a house on Cheney Walk looking over the boats. And we used to sketch them. His mother was an artist and his father an architectural historian. And we used to stand on the balcony and sketch them and paint them. So they were very much part of my imagination. So when I moved on to in fact, it was Esther Freud said to me, "Well, Alexandra, you've fallen in love with a man and a boat."
You know, that's so funny because my grandmother, she fell for someone who had a houseboat and she bought the houseboat. I don't exactly know what happened, but it ended up that she got taken to the cleaners and he took off. So I'm happy to hear that didn't happen to you.
Well, that didn't happen to me, but unfortunately, the people who own the boatyard are taking us to the cleaners, so this could have a very sticky and sad end. And what is awful is this week, the wonderful Egyptian novelist, Adaf Suef, I went to stay with on her beautiful houseboat on the Nile in Cairo. I mean, I had really bad houseboat envy. The Egyptian government has towed them all away.
Why is that?
Because they want to develop and make money out of the site. And it's an old bohemian community, just like ours in Chelsea. So Adaf has lost her home. She's lost everything. Absolutely tragic. and who knows what's going to happen with ours. But we're like the last bit of old Chelsea. It's like the Chelsea I remember from my childhood is this bit. So it's particularly precious to me.
It's untrammeled capitalism. That's the problem. Really. I mean, why do we live together in cities? It's to cultivate places like you have.
I know. But I think that all we can do is appreciate every day living here and get everybody joy out of it. And then whatever will happen will happen.
Okay. Well, could you tell me about your father, please?
My father, so the name Pringle is Scottish, so he was Scottish, but he was actually born in England because his father was a Liberal MP. And my father was a late child, so he had an old father, and his father actually died of a heart attack when my father was 10. But he was a Liberal MP, and he was a great friend of Asquith and supporter of Asquith and an enemy of Lloyd George. And he was a wee free Liberal, and he was known for being very disruptive and difficult in the House of Commons. And in fact, there was a verb invented called Pringle, which meant to create a rumpus. And G.K. Chesterton wrote a poem that goes like this. How I love humanity that is so fair and Pringlish, and how I hate the horrid branch who never will be English.
Couldn't say that today, could you?
No, you couldn't. Yeah, so he was brought up in this political household, but my father was actually a socialist. He was a communist before the war, and he was a socialist, and he was a teacher. So he had other ambitions. He had an ambition to be a barrister, as his father had been, and he got his exams but couldn't afford the pupillage, because he got married and had a baby and all the rest of it. And then what he really wanted most of all was to be a member of parliament. And he was always a Labour councillor all his life. He stood for parliament twice for the Labour Party. And his constituency was Westminster, which is the safest Tory seat probably in the world. We had so much fun. He was the first person ever to canvass the servants' quarters of Buckingham Palace. He got the front page of the Times for doing that. And he doubled the Labour vote. It was the second time he stood was when Harold Wilson first got in the 60s. And then my father had a heart attack. My family of heart attacks. And so he gave up politics and continued as an English teacher. And he's a wonderful teacher, I think. And of course, that was very important in my development. The conversations he and I had about books and books that he gave me from when I was. For example, he gave me Jane Austen and Thomas Hardy to read when I was 11. So I was lucky. And he was very keen on T.S. Eliot. And he and my parents met just after the war. And my mother was also a teacher.
Was your father disappointed in his life or not?
I think he was professionally disappointed. He was an extraordinary father and family person. And he was, I think, a really wonderful teacher, but it's not just me. I took my parents, they were very old, they were in their 80s, to the Groucho Cup for lunch. And a completely strange man came up and said, "Are you Mr. Pringle?" And he said, "Yes." And he said, "You won't remember me, but you taught me at Westminster City School. And I had recently come from Russia. My name is Anatole Konetsky. And I became a writer because of you. You changed my life. Thank you."
You know, that's exactly what authors love to hear, which is, "Your book changed my life."
And also, you know, for my father, had a lot of management, my mother, because she was a very complicated and dramatic person. Took up a lot of emotional space in the house. So he was a very gentle person who stepped back, very nurturing, very gentle.
So you didn't lack for love then?
No, not at all. Not from my father or my mother, although the love for my mother was very complicated and certainly became complicated. But she came from a very complicated background. Her parents her family were Berber Moroccan Jews. They came from the Ephraim. They were very ancient, pre-Babylonian Jews. And they were traders. They had caravans that went from Timbuktu to Mogador, with ostrich feathers and drum Arabic and spices and so on. And then when my mother was small, her father, my grandfather, imported indigo from Pondicherry and cotton from Manchester for the cloth for the Yumen, for the Tuareg. And then it went bankrupt, probably because he was useless at business, but the war didn't help. And he used to train our horses and sell them to the French army. So she was brought up partly in Morocco and partly in Britain. And the family left. They had a conversation about whether to stick out the war in Morocco or go to England. And my mother and her brother desperately wanted to go to England. She's a teenager. And they got the last boat out. And my mother hated her family. And the minute she could, she joined the ATS, the Women's Army. She was 17 and she became a driver. And her whole life changed. And she never forgave her father for not educating her. He made her leave school when she was 16. But she got to go to art school after the war because the government gave grants to people who'd done war service. And she got into goldsmiths. And she met my father through the poet Tanbi Mutu, the Salonese poet, and also a poet called Peter Russell, who my father shared a flat with. And Peter Russell had been in love with my mother during the war. They met, and he, in a jealous fury, when they got married, kicked over and destroyed their only wedding present, which was a coffee pot. Anyway, they were part of that sort of post-war Bohemian poetry, French poet society. But when they got married, they removed themselves from that.
So what happened to Peter Russell? Did he just marry someone else, or was he in love with her for the rest of his life? Or
no, 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 no. I think he was in love with a lot of people. I think he married a Canadian at some point. Bisexual.
Right.
And I once saw him in Venice in a misty night, and the friend I was with knew him a bit because he lived in Venice for years, and this man stumbled over this bridge in the fog, and my friend said, "That's Peter Russell." Peter Russell was an acolyte of Ezra Pound.
Well, who wasn't? Really, he had such a network, didn't he? Okay, so you had a very interesting childhood then, obviously.
It wasn't one of those childhoods full of exciting and disturbing things. It was quite a regular childhood, but we were in Chelsea, which was amazing. My parents rented a tiny Regency cottage off the King's Road, which had no bathroom, lavatory in a shed in the yard. And it was completely working class street. And, you know, that was in the 50s. And then Mary Quant opened the Bazaar, and my mother had been at art school with her. We used to stand along the street corner and chat to her. And I watched the 60s happen, and the hippies then, and then punk. Well, I was too young, sadly, to be involved in it.
No, but what I'm saying is that it sounds like your parents had it. Interesting, you know, circle of friends, and so you would have gotten to know at least some of them, right?
Yes, absolutely. I was very, very lucky. And in fact, the people who had the house on Cheyne Walk, he was called J.M. Richards, and he wrote a very famous book called The Making of Modern Architecture, and he was editor of the Architectural Review, and his wife Kit was a painter, and they took me because I was like the son of sister, their son Alexander. Tragically died when he was 16 and I was 18. But until then, they used to take me with them on holiday. And for example, I went to stay with Lee Miller and Roland Penrose when I was 11. So that was pretty extraordinary weekend. And yeah. I remember it so well.
Yeah, I would say it probably clearly influenced you in your decision of where to head in terms of work.
Yes, definitely.
That job at the art magazine sounds like fun.
Oh, it was the best fun. It was the absolute best fun. I went to, after I failed to get into university because I was so bad at my schoolwork, and I was basically reading novels the whole time instead of working. And so I went to a tech in Cambridge Tech. And after I'd graduated, I went to live in Italy. I was taught English for a year. Then I came back and I sort of thought I wanted to work in publishing, and that way that you do it. Actually, what had happened was my last months at Cambridge Tech, one of my English tutors, who was a friend of Peter Russell's, and this is how strange life is, started a poetry festival in Cambridge, and I got involved in it. And it was then that I thought, I want to work with writers. And it was electrifying. I mean, writers, they were poets like amazing Robert Duncan, Robert Creeley, Ted Hughes. They came from all over the world this week in Cambridge, and I just thought, this is the life, this is what I want. So I was thinking of not particularly of poetry. In fact, my older brother said to me, perhaps you have a talent for poetry, and I said, no, I have a talent for poets. Without thinking, but you know what, there was something there.
Poets are dangerous.
I know, that's why I love them. It was so exciting, you know. And all the fighting and drinking, and I just thought, this is the life I want, the life I want. And so I was sort of looking in a rather hopeless kind of way for a job, and I didn't know how to do that, just looking in the Times for advertisements. But one day I wandered into an art gallery to see a woman who had worked in HR at the tech that I'd been. So hello, and I said, I'm looking for a job in publishing, and she said, oh, there's this man who's starting this new magazine and he's looking for an assistant. And so I rang him immediately and went to have my interview in the Museum Tavern in a pub. There were a lot of artists there. And he hired me. And it was £5 a week, 5 mornings a week. And I had to teach English to keep myself going. I lived in a room in Whitechapel with mice and rats and a Bangladeshi sweatshop underneath me, and I shared a lavatory with the whole house and had no bathroom. There's a no bathroom theme that goes through my life. I used to wash in a bucket. But the magazine was, I loved the editor. He was called Peter Townsend. He lived in China for years. He had been editor of Studio International. He knew all the artists of the time, and we used to sit in this pub, the Clown Museum Street, and artists were all over the world would come to see him, and he'd take you to private views. And I just had a ball. But then I did something very stupid, which was I married an artist. I've been married 2 times.
So, okay, wait a minute. You didn't marry a poet, you married an artist.
Yes.
Now that's just as bad, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And how long did that last for?
2 years. But in the course of that, I realized that I would have to earn money because he sure wasn't going to.
Yeah, it's definitely like he's not a banker.
No, no, no. I look back on my life and I'm quite astonished by the fact that I somehow never, ever put myself up with anyone remotely rich.
Well, you did it yourself, though, didn't you?
I've always had to do everything myself.
Okay, so did you edit when you were with the magazine?
When I was editorial assistant, and so I had to do, obviously. There were just 3 of us. There was the man who owned the magazine, Jack Wendler. There was the editor, Peter Townsend, and me. And Jack's wife used to do some work and advertise. So I used to have to, you know, print out the address labels, take copies to the galleries to sell, roll out subscriptions and post them. But Peter was such a wonderful mentor. He got me editing pieces and then doing little bits of writing for what was the Art Notes section. And so I did learn a great deal in that. And I would have stayed on much longer because I was so happy. But the £5 a week was a big problem.
Okay, so what specifically did you learn?
I learned how magazines put together. not something that I obviously use in my life now, but it was extremely interesting and useful. I learned how to work with writers, and I think that's a very, very important skill.
Okay, so how do you work with writers?
You're very nice on the whole.
You're very nice to them and what?
Yeah, on the whole, you're very
nice. On the whole, yes.
You look after them.
Yes. Well, they want to be catered to.
Yeah. Yeah, of course they do. And there was this writer, Peter Fuller, who became very famous, and he used to come to finish his copy, and he always had a cold and was miserable and used to sit over the typewriter. Part of my job was just to, like, make him feel happier while he was doing that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you want to try and get the best out of them. So how do you do that?
I think that is a huge mixture of building of confidence, which I think is really important, but also knowing how to lead them in different directions. And one of the things that I've learned, and I've made the mistake of not doing that, is that if you don't temper your criticism with good things, you get into trouble. And there have been times where I have felt that I worked with a writer for so long that our relationship is so robust, I can go straight into the kill, and I'm pretty much always wrong.
Wrong?
Yeah, to do that.
You can't really, for example, you can't really call someone's wife ugly.
Exactly, or their child an idiot. Whatever. No, exactly. So being respectful of the work is important and appreciative of it. And of course, every writer is different, and there's some that you can be more robust with. And it helps if they've got a very good sense of humor. You can do it through humor. And because if you can tease someone, then it's a great help. And I was brought up with a mother who teased. I like being teased, so I'm happy to be teased back.
Yeah, that's so important. Not to take yourself too seriously.
Yeah.
Okay. What about your role, Jen? I'm just going to riff off a few things here, activities or that sort of thing. So, for example, convincing the author to believe in their own vision and voice. Is that important?
Yes, I think that's incredibly important. And that's what I mean when I say confidence, building of confidence.
Okay. So, in other words, what they've got to say is worth saying, or what are you going to tell them?
What they're saying is worth saying, and also a lot of how they're doing it is worth it. But that to make the book realize itself, that more work needs to be done, and to be able to, in an ideal world, suggest possibilities. And I think of editing as a conversation. And so it is never an editor telling an author what they should do or how they should do it.
No.
It's about talking possibilities and lots of what if. So what if, and sometimes they're quite dramatic things. What if you kill off this character? Mm. What if you change the tense of the book?
Yeah.
What if you change the point of view and you go from the third person to the first person or vice versa? All of those things that can make an enormous difference. It's that strange thing with a book when you read a draft and it's not yet lifted off the ground. And I think when it's working, it levitates, literally takes off.
What does that mean?
It means it sings. It has life. It has breath.
And again, the way you recognize that is through some kind of instinct?
Yeah. You just know it.
Yeah.
And it's like when you read something absolutely wonderful, the hairs on your arms stand up.
Yes.
And your breathing changes slightly.
Okay, so that's why they hire you, for the hair that stands up on your arm.
Luckily, it's not too thick.
Right, but I mean, your hair stands up at the right book. I mean, that's the question, right? Is everyone? Lots of people's hair stands up, but it's got to stand up for the right thing.
Well, How do you know? I mean, all of publishing has centuries, but my God, at the moment, likes to feel that it knows how to do things. And the point is, I don't know what we're doing. You're not a hustler. And some people have a bit more luck than others. And that's really what it is. And the weird thing in my life is that probably the greatest successes, literally in terms of sales, have happened. It's happened completely on its own. The books have done it on their own.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? You've got to, I suppose, you get word of mouth going, but if the book isn't any good, it's not gonna take off.
And a publisher can fling enormous sums of money at a book.
Yeah.
That's me. People are gonna buy it. It'll help, but it's not gonna make it happen.
Okay. So what's the difference between the magazine editing and book editing?
Well, it's the long haul.
That's it, eh?
Yeah, it's a very long haul, and it's a more intimate process, a less cerebral process.
So it seems to me then, there's these three different areas. There's the emotional area that you're working on. There's the craft area, and then there's the business area, right?
Yeah.
Can you hit the most important things in each one of those?
So there's the emotional, there's the craft, and there's the business. There isn't one thing.
You don't think that there's a hierarchy?
Oh, well, I think everybody has different ones. I would say, but that's just who I am. For me, the emotional and the craft. And the business side is incredibly important. But I really think it's about balancing all of it. But for me, what I personally care about, it's like I care about all of this more than I care about the publishing industry. I'm not much interested in the publishing industry. My friends are like, all of this, they're not other publishers or agents.
Right. Right. Yeah. Why am I doing what I'm doing? It's for this kind of, it's a fun, educational, but it's connection. It's a conversation. Is that what you were after when you went into the book publishing business and the editing? Is that you craved close communication with smart people who loved the same sort of thing you did?
Yes, I think so. Yes. And then I learned all sorts of things like to love the process of publishing and how you can, as an editor, be a sort of magician with a book. It was actually Carmen Camille that taught me, because she started doing publicity before she became a publisher.
This is Virago, right?
Yes.
Where you went after...
Art Monthly.
Yes.
The editor has to be responsible for every single bit of the book. So it's also the visual side of it, how it looks, but also how to get it out in the world. And I remember when I was at Virago, the first novel I ever published was Lucy Ellman's Sweet Desserts. And learning how to get quotes from authors. And then I remember one day the books had just come in and I was having lunch with Clive James and I bought him a copy and said, I love this book and so on, and gave it to him. And he chose it as his book of the year and the Observer. That's magic, And then his quote went on the front of the paperback. So learning all of those things, which is about connections and about bringing people together. And I love that side of it's like a giant party.
Well, yes. That is interesting, isn't it? It's like when you think of an editor, basically, it seems to me, the role is very much, as you said, it's everything. It's like each editor, at least when you get to a certain level, is a publisher.
Definitely. Definitely. I think of it as, I think really good editors are publishers who have a 360-degree angle on every book, that they put their fingers on every single bit.
Right.
That you don't just edit it, send it off to press and step back. You step way forward at that point. And you have to champion your books and you have to work for them. You have to like wake up in the middle of the night and think, oh, I should send this book to so and so. So much about that. And always whenever I party, any kind of gathering, felt that I wanted to talk to one or two or three people about particular books and then send them afterwards. You're kind of like working it all the time.
Right. What you want to do is sort of keep push, like it's a bit like a like an old car. You know, you've got the lovely car, but you have to push it to get it to start going, and then it goes on its own.
Yeah.
And the way you push it is just to talk to as many people about it as you can.
Yeah, and send it. When I get proofs, I get so many of them. I send them out to like 50, 60, 80 people, often with handwritten cards or letters.
The proofs?
Yeah.
And you're hoping they'll give you feedback?
Yeah, or that they'll just talk about it. Nowadays, of course, it's on social media. You know, give a quote or just, it's just part of the life of the book, getting people aware of it. Because every book needs as much help as it can get. Well, and it's sometimes, you know, sometimes you'll send a book out just because you think somebody would like to read it. And then you're really surprised. I published an astonishing novel by D.H. Lawrence called Tenderness. And I sent it to, amongst many other people, I sent it to Elizabeth Gilbert, who I knew was writing and not really reading, but I just wanted her to have it. And I thought, this incredible email. She had fallen passionately in love with it. You just think, isn't this the best?
Well, why is that the best? It's because you think it's great and someone agrees with you?
Well, you want people to love your books. It's like you want them to love your children.
Yeah.
And if it's also people who you respect and admire, and that's very special.
I mean, there is a sense of validation there too.
Yes, because until it's published, you don't know what other people are going to think. So there's a bit of you that's scared and a bit of you that thinks, am I the emperor in my new clothes?
Right.
And so there is absolutely.
Yeah. I was speaking with the head of this program I was telling you about in Prague, and he's written a piece on his first book and how he couldn't keep his hands off it, you know, and how it truly is again, depending on the person, psychologically validating as well.
Yes, absolutely. And particularly with the first book. That's pretty really the unknown.
Yeah. I'm concerned about I know you're holding it up there, but it's...
Still bad, is it?
Yeah, it's really not good. But you know what I might have to do is I might have to come over on and visit you on your houseboat.
Okay. You'd be very welcome.
You land at, if that's a way of putting it, at Bloomsbury in 1999. Was that right around Harry Potter time?
Yes, it was. It was. The first one had been published, and the second one was soon to be published. So there was a lot of excitement, but it was before it went insane. It was all taking off at that moment.
And you didn't have anything to do with that then?
No, because that was the children's division.
Yes, I was thinking about that, although it's, you know, I mean, of course, lots of adults read all of them to our daughters and kids, you know. And there also, I think, is a surprising number of adults who actually read it on their own, right?
Yes, in fact, we did publish adult editions.
Yes. And that obviously must have been a huge part of Bloomsbury's success, yes?
Yes, it was absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
But it was also frightening way. And we knew it was going to come to an end. I mean, not that it's finished, of course it hasn't, because Harry Potter continues to be incredibly important. But when we got to the end of the series, that was a very critical. Partly because we're a PLC, a publicly owned company. And so we have to grow every year.
Yes, that's terrible. You have to grow every year. I think that's bullshit. Really.
How it is, yeah, it's capitalism.
I clearly sympathize with your father's political views. Okay, so Axe Bloomsbury, and let's just continue a bit with Harry Potter. What role did the agent play versus, I know you didn't get into it right away, but I'm sure it's part of what your work, and I know you must be sick of talking about it, but the role that the agent played with Rowling and the role that the publisher played, how does that sort of shake out?
Well, the agent had the foreign rights, so obviously the agent was in control of that and in control of doing the deals with us for future books. That was really it was a business relationship.
Yes. Someone at the company was the editor or what?
Yeah, yes. Somebody in the company. The editor who originally bought Harry Potter left to start his own imprint. But there was a young woman there who was Joe Rowling's editor at Bloomsbury, and she is her editor through the whole series.
I see. What's her name?
Emma. Second name. Left some years ago.
Okay.
Sorry, I just can't remember. Come back to me.
So how did you climb how did you succeed in that company?
At Bloomsbury?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Like how, what explains your rise to the top?
Well, I came in at the top. You know, I was hard to take over.
That's true.
So it wasn't that I had done all my rising, so to speak, okay, in the years before. Okay. So I came.
Well, let me wind that back then.
Okay.
About all that rising, then, like, how come you did all that rising?
I find it very amusing nowadays that young women, mainly women who work in publishing, come in and ask about their career.
Right.
Career paths, because I've never ever thought about a career or a plan or a path. So right. I just like stumbled through. I'm really just doing kind of what felt right or what happened to me. So obviously I had to leave Art Monthly because I had to earn money because I was poor. And so I went to a minuscule amount of money at Virago. And I found that I went part-time for 3 years there because I found it very difficult working for Carmel Khalil. And I went back to university part-time. So, you know, it was a mess, really. And then when I was 30, I went back full-time and took over the classic series, running it, although Carmen still worked on it. And that was very much my heartland. My mother had given me to read as a child.
Yeah, that's nice, yeah. That must have been very satisfying, getting these women back into print.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. And in a way, my experience on Art Monthly was very useful for the commissioning of the new introductions and working with the authors on those. And then I started commissioning new books. But I was at Rowling for 12 years, and I had very little confidence, and I certainly didn't feel that I was employable anywhere else for a long time. And it was really in my late 30s, and by that time I was part of the management team, really, because I was the fourth person to join, and I joined as what was called the shit worker, really, is what we called it. And sort of learned everything there and ended up as a long, hard process, and I'm a tortoise. You know, there are tortoises and hares in the world, and I'm a complete tortoise. And I never had a feeling that I had a burning need for a great career. But by the time I was in my mid-30s, I thought, if I don't be Rowling, I'll spend the rest of my life here. And that is not a good thing for a human being. And I was offered the job at Hamish Hamilton, so that just happened to me. And it happened to me at a very difficult time in Rowling's history. And it was a perfect exit, and it was a perfect list for me. So I felt very lucky. So I went to Hamish Hamilton But within 4 years, within 3 years, I knew that corporate life did not suit me. It just was not me. And so that was why I bailed out to become an agent. And that was because I had lunch with this agent who said he was looking for someone. So I said, what about me? So do you see what I mean? There was no plan. There was no plan. And what I always did have was this very strong sense of the books I loved and what I wanted to do with them, the authors that I loved. And then yet another lunch, I have one of these. She says she's looking for someone to take over from her when she retires. And would I think about it? I took 4 months because I knew it was the most important decision of my life. I didn't really know. I didn't take 4 minutes because it was so obvious. But I felt really responsible to my authors, some of whom have followed me from Fargo to Hamilton to agenting, and it's very disruptive and difficult for authors to have this upheaval in their lives. But then I thought I had to do it. So that was how I ended up at and everything is just the accumulated experience of years, isn't it? Just
bad
as you feel
at all. Okay, just winding down here then. It seems to me that what you're saying is that you've got an instinct or a taste or something that you're able to determine something that's both good and viable economically.
Not always. Many of my books don't work. As with every year.
Okay, that's true, yes, because it's certainly not batting 1,000%. In order to succeed in the way you have, you must have a better batting average than normal. I mean, they must have, you have to be seen as someone who can make the company money.
Yes, I guess so. I imagine so, I hope so. But I think a lot of, in fact, I gave a speech about this recently, that editors need confidence and they need people to trust their taste. And it all comes from there. The best happens from there. And I just have been very lucky. I sometimes fall violently in love with a book, like The Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, or Eat, Pray, Love. And those are just weird experiences, and it's like falling in love. But if you have the kind of strength of mind and confidence to follow that, and sometimes to even go against colleagues to do that, then you can have wonderful rewards. Every book that works, there are dozens that you weep for. Really beautiful, wonderful books that people ignore.
So yes, it's interesting, this dichotomy between, you know, you have to think that, the same for an author, you have to think you're better than everyone else. But on the other hand, you know, you're racked by self-doubt.
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting dichotomy, isn't it?
Yes.
And if you aren't able to argue your case with the rest of the people in the company, then you're not going to, is that it? Is it how passionate your argument is, or how solid it is compared to other people's, and then it's your track record, or what?
Well, sometimes a company of its own accord just falls in love with something as well, and that's great. And sometimes they don't. So everybody seems to be in love with Jonathan Strange, and nobody fell in love with Eat, Pray, Love. And it took 4 years for that book to work, and it sure wasn't anything we did. You know? But I banged on about it because I felt so strongly about it. It's weird, you know. So sometimes it all comes together. Sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes the company can all love a book, do everything right, do it beautifully, and it still doesn't work.
Okay, well, I'm not sure how beautifully this has come together, Alexandra, because of the freaking technology. But let me give it an edit, and hopefully it'll turn out. So it's not the houseboat. Is that what you're trying to say?
No, it's definitely the houseboat. Yes.
Well, just to wind down then, finally, Have you said everything? Like, have you divulged all of your secrets to me, or are you keeping some, you know, aside? But
no sane human being.
Okay, well, we'll save that maybe for the time I come and visit you on your houseboat. How's that?
All right.
Okay, well, I really appreciate the time you've spent with me, and thanks very much.
Okay, I hope it's going to be okay.
Yes, okay.
Right. Good to meet you.
Likewise.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.